I am not fighting to stay in this country. I'm fighting for justice in this country. And my fight is connected to the fights of so many other people who wants to see justice in this country.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Mohsen Mahdawi has come a long way since being released from a Vermont jail last April. Mahdawi is a Palestinian student at Columbia University and a green card holder who lives in Vermont. He co-founded Columbia's Palestinian Student Union and was also president of the Columbia University Buddhist Association. Secretary of State Marco Rubio justified Mahdawi's arrest last year by saying that his advocacy of human rights in Palestine could undermine the Middle East peace process. Vermont federal judge Jeffrey Crawford ordered Mahdawi's release on bail, comparing his arrest to the unlawful repression of free speech under McCarthyism. The Trump administration has appealed, and the case, Mahdawi versus Trump, was argued before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York in September. A decision is pending. This February, Judge Nina Froese, an immigration judge in Massachusetts, blocked Mahdawi's deportation in a separate case. Last week, Judge Froese was fired by the Trump administration as part of its purge of immigration judges who stand in the way of Trump's mass deportation program. In the middle of all this, Mahdawi graduated from Columbia University last year with a bachelor's degree. This fall, he began a master's degree at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs. I spoke with Mohsen Mahdawi on April 14th, the one-year anniversary of his arrest. He was back in Vermont on a short break. Mohsen Mahdawi, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
What a great joy to be with you, David.
I remember our first meeting was taking a walk in the woods in Vermont shortly after you were released from 16 days in jail. And I understand that you have taken the opportunity of this one-year anniversary of your release from jail to return to Vermont. Tell me what you're doing today.
Yeah, the memories of our hike. The water was strong in the streams. The hill was steep when we were going up and barely catching our breaths.
Yes.
And the view was very serene on the top of the hill when we get there, and we had an in-depth conversation while seeing the unfolding hills of Vermont and New Hampshire. And this memory, which was technically a few days after my release, not much, maybe a week. So I was very eager to be in nature after spending 16 days in prison. And I thought to myself, you know, my very busy schedule in the city and traveling between cities. And I said to myself, last minute, if I want to really honor my spirit, where would I go? And the answer was very clear that I would go to the land that I love, to the community that I love and that supported me. And I decided to come to Vermont to spend a few days in nature, to a level of solitude.
What does it do to you to be here? You have been in the international public eye in the year since your arrest and then being freed. What does it do to you to be here in Vermont?
It is... you know, many people see me on TV, in the news, doing interviews, and often people don't think about the human element that one should have. And many people always wonder, where do you get your energy and your strength and your clarity from? And it's not that complicated of a practice. It's just coming back to be simple, to be human, to be in nature, where I feel a level of tranquility, a level of peace, and I feel connected to the elements around of me, to the trees, to the sky, to the lakes that are around, and rivers, and breathing the fresh air. That's a sense of freedom, strong sense of freedom. And that also the same condition that allowed me to heal from my childhood wounds and the trauma that I carried from the refugee camp. And also the community that hosted me, that sheltered me, gave me home, that visited me when I was in prison, gave me food and gave me water and protested for me, and has continued to support me not only during my detention and after, but years before. This is what humanity is, and this is what joy is when you feel connected.
So much has happened in the year since you were arrested in Vermont at your naturalization interview. Starting with just a few weeks after you were released, you walked across the stage at Columbia University to graduate with a bachelor's degree. Now you are back enrolled in graduate school at Columbia University, and your court cases. You have been in and out of court. Talk about what's been going on this past year.
It feels like it's a year that's going with the speed of a light. So much has happened, and all what I had to do is to continue to reassure myself that, things are going to be okay, and I trust that this is going to be the path, and just handle it one thing at a time and manage your time wisely. So indeed, a lot has happened. Beside, since the moment I was released until today, I have not stopped my activism in a way or another. I visited tens of communities all across the world. Sorry, all across the United States. I wish I can go across the world, but I am restricted with my movement. I've visited universities and gave workshops about organizing and coalition building. I visited churches and synagogues and community centers. I've done tens of interviews almost every week, at least an average one or two interviews since my release. And I have engaged in academia, going back to do the work that I ought to do, focusing on peace building, conflict resolution, negotiation, and mediation. And I had also balanced all of that with the courts, the two cases, one in the federal and one in the immigration. And as one might imagine, it's a lot to juggle, but I feel grateful for that, this big responsibility that I have that keeps me busy and keeps me hopeful as well.
Explain the two cases that are continuing now.
Well, the original case, the witch hunt case that the government came after me for, is basically a deportation case based on Marco Rubio's memorandum, which is based on the Immigration Nationality Act that declared me as a foreign, as a threat to foreign policy and undermining the peace process in the Middle East. And this case aimed to deport me from this country, and it is handled in immigration courts. Luckily, as you may remember, I was able to stay in Vermont. I was not basically sent to Louisiana or elsewhere, and my case is being handled now in Massachusetts. And this case now, it has progressed to the point that it was dropped, in fact, by a judge, dismissed, because it did not follow the right procedure. And the same judge who has dismissed the case I'm not sure if you saw in the news, but was fired by basically the executive branch a few days ago, along with other judges. And the
Yes, and
other judge.
I wanted to get your thoughts on that. So you were back in the news this week because the judge who threw out your deportation case has now him herself, it was a woman, as I recall.
That's right. Her name is Nina Frost.
And was this a person you did you ever meet this person, this judge?
I only met her over the WebEx meeting, which was basically the court hearing. That's the only time I knew who she was, and I saw her like on video. But
How do you
prior to that.
feel about the fact that this judge has now lost her job as a result of throwing out your deportation case?
You know, I'm remembering Judge Crawford in Vermont and what he said during the court. He said, "History may not repeat itself, but often rhymes." And what Judge Nina Frost is going through and went through with this is reminding me also what the Nazis have done to judges who were impartial. In Germany, she has decided to hold the rule of the law firmly, to be impartial, and to rule based on the body of law and based on the oath that she had to do. And what the Trump's administration has done to her, firing her, leaving her without a job. And not only that, but also creating, much further harm by when her name is out and when they declare her as, as unfit for their policies. So she took a big risk, and I knew she was a courageous judge when she took that decision, and that decision did not come from nowhere. She followed the rule. So what the administration is doing, they are continuing this series of intimidation and a series of punishment for anybody who disagrees with them, including their own judges. And if there is a message that people need to understand that this is not only against this judge, this is also a tactic to deteriorate any decisions from the future judge who's going to be hearing my case, because they have to think in the back of their mind that they might lose their job and they might face the same level of intimidation and targeting and attacks.
And if you could just briefly, and we should also point out, I believe Judge Froese said she did not actually know who you were or anything about your case. She says she does not Google the people in front of her. She weighs the facts that are presented to her, which I thought was quite interesting. Just if you could say about the federal case, which is a separate case, and what that's about.
Yeah, if this tells you something about Judge Froese, it shows you her level of commitment to be impartial, to not involve her emotion, actually, to be as professional as possible. And I believe that, because when I said, "Good morning, Your Honor, my name is Mohsen Madawi," she didn't she it appeared to me that she didn't know anything about me. The federal case is related to my freedom, which is the habeas corpus. That means you cannot imprison somebody unjustly. And I was released based on an order from the federal court in Vermont, that is Judge Crawford. The government appealed it to the Second Circuit in New York, and the appeal was basically argued in September 30th. And to this date, we are still waiting for the decision to come out. A panel of three judges who heard my case, we don't know why is the delay, but they are taking much longer than expected.
I want to now expand the lens because among the things that have happened since you were released is that US has joined with Israel to attack Iran, and essentially start a conflict that has now spread across the Middle East. Israel has also invaded Lebanon. I want to just get your thoughts on what we are seeing right now, and how do you make sense of that? How should we be understanding this new dimension of the conflict?
The deterioration and destruction of the U.S. Constitution and of civil rights in this country that took place when the government came after me and other student activists are motivated by the same reason that the war is taking place in Iran, and that is Israel, shielding Israel from any criticism and giving it the justification it wants to continue killing and destroying livelihoods in the Middle East. When we protested and when we raised our voices, it was against war. And we said we are anti-war, we're protesting for human rights in support of constitutional law here and in support of international law. They tried to silence us, and by doing so, they have basically violated the constitution. And what we see now is a continuation of this series of supporting Israel blindly and destroying every American value that in service of Israel. Israel committed a genocide in Gaza, is maintaining an apartheid in the whole land between the river and the sea, not only in the West Bank, and now creating what we know as the vision for a greater Israel. That means Israel that has to be expanded to roughly four countries and to be able to become the dominant force in the Middle East. And what we see happening in Iran, the destruction in Iran, the destruction and killing in Lebanon, is just the U.S. supporting blindly Israel's agenda and being dragged into a war that it doesn't need to be dragged into. And on the cost of who? The cost is American taxpayer money and American basically reputation around the world. And the isolation that America will start feeling by all of these, horrendous and unjust, attacks and destruction doesn't have to be this way. There is a way towards peace, and I believe that peace is possible without the use of violence.
A number of observers have commented on how the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran and even the treatment of protesters here in the U.S. represents a kind of Israelization of conflict generally. You have personal experience of life under Israeli military occupation. I wonder what your thoughts on that, on how this is an extension of what you experienced.
Israel is dragging the United States into a swamp, into a mud hole. The U.S. has clear laws and principles that it used to follow in accordance with the Geneva Convictions and in accordance of international law. And what we see, basically the attack on the school that killed many children in Iran, this is something that the U.S. wouldn't do. That's Israel's mentality and articulation in a similar way how we saw things unfolding in Gaza and Lebanon. The attacks on hospitals in a similar way as well. The attacks on civilians and infrastructure. All of this is something I'm very familiar with. In the refugee camp, I saw Israeli military killing children. They killed my best friend in front of my eyes. I saw them killing people and torturing them after being killed. And two of my cousins who were killed after October 7th, out of four cousins, my cousin Maisara and my cousin Walid, their bodies are still held hostages after being killed by Israeli forces. And this is, this is in violation of international law, and in violation of even every spiritual law that we know. And they continue to, they created also a system of two tiers in terms of rights. So Palestinians don't have rights, the right to travel freely, even the right to live safely in their homes, the right of going and being in nature. And what we see in the US, the extension of ICE, and the way how they've been orchestrating, they have also created two tiers where basically immigrants, they consider them less of humans and they don't have rights. And we see the tactics that ICE has been using in this country, and we have seen clear evidence of collaboration and training between ICE and also Israeli forces. So the patterns are becoming very clear, not only to me, to many people across the US. And we see people on the right and the left are seeing that Israel, in fact, is weakening the United States, using its resources and weakening its moral stand and dragging it into a war that doesn't have to happen.
How has the war in the Middle East that's going on now, the US-Israeli war in Iran and in Lebanon, how has it impacted your family back in Palestine?
In a very difficult and destructive way, like the harm that my family is feeling now, is getting more difficult. Part of it is Israel has been using the coverage on the war and as a distraction from what they are doing in the West Bank. I have family members who have been forced out of their homes in Jenin refugee camp and in Tul Kerem refugee camp, and their homes have been destroyed. So they become refugees for the second time. And two of my family members who already have lost children during after October 7th, they are homeless. Actually, they are living with other family members in other places. In the refugee camp where my father and uncles and cousins live, the infrastructure has been destroyed. My father's house, my father's tiny store has been blown up by Israeli forces in the refugee camp. And I have cousins who are married and who live in towns that are close by settlements, and the horror that they face and they see from settler violence every week is just unbelievable. And I speak with them and they say, we don't know how to calm our children down. There is no regulation. You don't know when they're gonna come. They throw Molotovs on homes, they burn cars, they shoot people. And this is the violence is just escalating and expanding, and the world is not seeing it because it's focusing on the war in Iran.
Is your family being targeted because of their relationship with you?
We don't have a clear evidence that is the case, but what we see su is suggesting that my father was and my family was targeted specifically because it was the only kind of convenience store in the refugee camp that was blown up when there was an Israeli raid. And my brother was the only one in the whole street who was taken as a human shield and then tortured for and not allowed to sleep for 3 nights before he was released, even though he has a mental health issue. And in the street where my family lives, also other cousins were detained along with other neighbors. But there is no clear evidence that's the case, but all of the signs point that my family has been targeted. And my guess is because of my activism.
How does that affect you, knowing that the things you do in the United States may have a direct impact on your loved ones?
It makes me more clear and stronger, and it gives me more faith that what I am doing by speaking up my truth and advocating for the Palestinian people is the right path, that it is effective. And we know what they are scared of. I believe in nonviolence, and a big part of my belief, because I believe that the truth by itself has its own capacity to bring justice. And the truth for the Israeli system and for those who are supporting the unjust system is very scary. They're trying to ban us, to prevent us from saying our truth, even though we say it with compassion and love and tolerance and extending my arm always and my hand for peace. And I know the cost is heavy, but also I am not forgetting the cost that the people in Gaza have paid and are still paying. They lost, we're talking about whole families ha that has been erased. We're talking about tens of thousands of children who lost their limbs. We're talking about more than 70,000 people who have been killed. We're talking about destroying every element of life, including schools and hospitals and basic worship places. And we're talking about people living in tents and dying because of the lack of food and because of the cold, the lack of heat and enough warmth. So I can see the spectrum of suffering, and I can't help but believe that justice is coming, and it's not far away from this moment that we are living, as dark as it feels.
After your deportation case was thrown out in February, you issued a statement in which you said, "This decision is an important step toward upholding what fear tried to destroy, the right to speak for peace and justice." I thought of that when I watched the news of the fall of the Hungarian strongman Viktor Orban. And a motto of the opposition leader who defeated him, in the speeches he would give to the crowds of Hungarians, he kept repeating the statement, "Do not be afraid." Can you say something about the role of fear? How it is, really the foundation for so much of the kind of authoritarian power, and how telling people that they should not be afraid sort of takes that power away.
This whole fight, on a spiritual level, I see it as a fight between two energies, the energy of fear and the energy of love. And the energy of fear is what is motivating Trump and what's motivating Netanyahu and driving him, and what is motivating the whole system that is trying to shun people and shut them down and scare them and intimidate them. This is why they basically wanted to make an example of me and many other students, and why they are going after journalists as well and immigrant communities and so on to incite fear. And this battle, I think more and more people are realizing it. Roughly a year ago, when I was released, and one of my statements that echoed around the world was that when I said to President Trump and his cabinet, "I am not afraid of you," and I said it from a place of love, not a place of fear. And now we see this statement being echoed all over the world. In fact, also the Pope, Pope Leo, yesterday, he said, "I am not afraid."
Yes, I caught that, and that really jumped out at me.
So this is what is happening now. They're destroying humanity by dehumanizing other people and trying to create, tiers of rights and different systems for different people. That's supremacy by itself. And the rule of, not being afraid is because the moment we feel afraid, we will position ourselves in a state of survival. We cannot think and basically have imagination for the longer vision and for what we would want to manifest in this world. And actually, it disconnects us from others and it puts us in the same category of, an oppressed and oppressor. And it would put us in the same category of enemies. But we are breaking through this system because to break through it, we have to function from a place of love, not a place of fear, and hold those who are causing harm accountable for their actions. And I believe that we will be able to do that because also what's inspiring is to see humans all around the world protesting against the war and protesting for the rights of liberation for Palestinians and protesting here across the country for immigrant rights. And this is coming from a place of love, not a place of fear.
There are probably people listening to this and listening to you who wonder really in their hearts how to overcome fear. You know, you have reason to be fearful. You've already spent time in jail. Your friend and colleague, Mahmoud Khalil, is also being relentlessly harassed and persecuted. How do you do it? How do you keep from letting fear paralyze you?
It's all in the body. So when we feel fear, our body get tense. We feel tension, and usually the development of the emotions start from our core, from our stomach. And our breath would be affected. We will have shorter breath. We will stop. It actually steals away and robs us of our inner peace, fear. But when we are in a state of love, we're more relaxed, we're more able to think further, to relate to others, and so on. And the basic practice that I have is basically through meditation, because through meditation, the first thing I become aware of my body. Is it in a state of tension or is it relaxed? If it's in a state of tension, that's a form of fear because I understand that the spectrum of feelings, negative feelings, all negative feelings come from the root feeling, which is fear, and all positive feelings come from the root feeling, which is love. And fear causes our bodies to be put our body in a place of unease, and love relaxes it. So the first thing is becoming aware of my body. And then if it's at a place of tension, all what I have to do is to be aware of my breath and to trust that things will be okay and to breathe into the tension all the way into my belly button and breathe in and out, and then my body would become at ease, and my way of thinking would change. My reaction to the world would change. The other element of it is just having faith. You know, many people think that we're dealing with things on our own, and I have to take it all on our on my own. But I have faith that I am not alone, and I have faith that things will unfold in a way that justice and peace will be achieved. And we have to center ourselves. This is how we stay hopeful while still doing the work from a place of love, not a place of fear, not reactive to what is being thrown at us.
You are a practicing Buddhist. How does that help you, and how does that inform your work?
I am a practicing Buddhist on daily basis, and the Buddhist theology is something it makes a great sense for me in the world, and especially in the world of activism and suffering and pain and trauma, and it helps me to empathize and to understand the root causes not only with people who are being oppressed but also with the oppressor as well. So it helps me to break through the boundaries and the divisions that our minds create and that the systems create. And while it makes me stronger and more committed to the causes, because in Buddhism, We believe that the whole idea behind Buddhism, the purpose of Buddhism, is to alleviate all forms of suffering. And that's what I am committed to.
What is next for you, Mohsen? Say a little bit about your studies, your current studies at Columbia, and what do you hope to do with the degree and skills that you are acquiring?
So, a number of things. There's a big project. I never stopped my work and my activism, and I can see the possibility and the need to have a much larger coalition that brings people together, even those who usually disagree with each other, to agree on common values and principles. And that is in alignment with saving the democracy in this country. I am not fighting to stay in this country. I'm fighting for justice in this country. And my fight is connected to the fights of so many other people who wants to see justice in this country. So this summer, I have a number of things going on. One is finalizing a book about activism and coalition building, that I think it has a lot of lessons that would be helpful to communities organizing across the United States. And another that I am working actually on a peace project with an organization that is called Interpeace, a little bit over the summer. And my vision is to be able to. There is a lot, they call this state that we are in right now a state of rupture. But a state of rupture is also, and a state of a crisis is a state of opportunities. Opportunities to redefine boundaries, to reimagine what could be possible. And that is a big part of my study. I'm connecting with many people, unlikely allies. People would be surprised to see and to hear who I'm meeting with and who I am building with and who I am connecting with.
Like
And
who?
I don't want to expose to expose people right now, because a lot of this work is has to be done with consent. But people who you would not even imagine that they would sit at the same table with me.
Can you
And
just sort of describe in general terms?
yeah, people who used to people on the right, people who are on the conservative side, and people who are on the radical left side as well. So I'm trying to bridge to bring people to agree on what they care about the most and what they can support as a first step. I'm also speaking with previous ambassadors to the United States, with diplomats, with negotiators, and with people who used to be in positions of power before, who are seeing that what's happening in the US is very dangerous. And I think we have a common goal. The goal is to end wars and to restore constitutional rights in this country, and to work from a place of empathy and compassion rather than anger and resentment and hate. And the next step, also organizations that care deeply about civil rights, where we are hoping to have university tours and to be able to empower and engage again and uplift the students' voices, where basically this whole series of murder of constitutional rights started with the universities, and we're going to bring it up and back to life.
And finally, Mohsen, I think many people, as they confront the morning headlines on any given morning, are feeling overwhelmed. They're feeling despair, and they're feeling frightened by the spreading disorder, by the suffering that is going on in the world. How do you deal with this, and what gives you hope to continue doing the work that you do?
Yeah, I feel in the same bit hole at the beginning of this war. And I had to take a break and to realize that it was not feeding my energy and it was dimming my light and my creativity and my imagination. So one of the things that I implemented directly after probably 2 weeks of the war, I started to not engage with the news early in the morning. And in fact, I did a research that you need the first hour or two of your day for yourself to reset, to be able to see what is on your mind, what's in your heart, to have a cup of coffee, to look outside and see the sky, to meditate, to do a prayer. Those are all self-care and self-love. And there is this Buddhist saying that says, an empty cup cannot fill another empty cup. So this is how you fill your cup. Take you the space and the time for yourself in the morning, the first half an hour or 2 hours, to recenter, to read something not in the news, something that would energize you, that would feed your spirit, would feed your soul, to do some exercise. And then you can tap into the news and keep a balance between what you consume and what you give to the world. Because also the models of the media that we have is based on making us addictive and to consume more. So this is one advice is take the first, half an hour or an hour of your morning for yourself and don't use the phone, just center. And the second part is for me, the meditation and the Buddhist practice, it doesn't have to be Buddhist. There is mindfulness meditation that is fit for everybody. There is no religious element in it. I would encourage people to do that. And the third one is just make intentional time to connect with people who you care for, who you love, and share those circles because community re-energizes us and empowers us and makes us know and feel that we are not alone. Be reassured that justice will prevail and don't surrender to fear. Don't give up to fear.
Well, Mohsen Mahdawi, I want to thank you again for joining us on the Vermont Conversation, and it's a pleasure to talk to you while you are in Vermont.
The pleasure is mine, and sorry we missed the opportunity of another hike, but we'll make it happen soon.
Well, I'm hearing the birds chirping in the background, so it sort of feels like we're on a hike. That was Mohsen Mahdawi, a Palestinian-born graduate student and human rights activist at Columbia University, speaking to me on the one-year anniversary of his arrest in Vermont. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks so much for listening.